Still some sunshine. Wind is off the east at 14. 48 degrees Racine. Now 51 in Kenosha. 48 as well for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Very pleased to welcome back to our studios Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Economics at Carthage College, Director of the Clawson Center, author of The Cold War, a columnist whose work appears in newspapers across the country and in other countries as well. And we're really glad that on a monthly visit, Professor Sear joins us to talk about a plethora of different topics and to offer his analysis of events here and around the world. But Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you. And I want to thank you again for having our alum, Christina Bruff, currently the Bureau of African Affairs at the State Department, and a Carthage graduate, as well as a Peace Corps veteran and Princeton University graduate here. She was our executive in residence last week and did just a superb job.
Great. And it was good to talk to her because, for a number of reasons, but one of them being that so often we as Americans tend to first of all, underestimate the significance of the continent of Africa and tend to think of it probably rather simplistically. And as somebody who works with the region of Africa, as she does, she obviously has a much more sophisticated understanding of Africa's place in the world and just what a complex part of the world it is.
She certainly is knowledgeable, isn't she? That came across very effectively during her hour-long discussion with you.
Well, we have lots to talk about. Probably where we should begin is the biggest headline, which is of the recently completed presidential primary in the state of New York, and the resounding victories that were scored by both Donald Trump and Hillary Rodham Clinton. And maybe just a word, first of all, about where we've been up until now and how significant the state of New York is in the proceedings, in the lineup of presidential primaries.
It's very significant. They both reconfirmed their status as the front runner in their respective party. The state of New York has been, it's now the second largest. It was the largest for many, many decades, and historically has been an important source of presidential candidates. So the fact that Mr. Trump is from New York and Mrs. Clinton has been able to establish plausible residency and get elected from New York, I think that makes it particularly important for their quest for their party's nominations. It makes it even more likely that former Secretary Clinton will be the Democratic nominee.
They were saying on NPR this morning that, I think in their words, the numbers game that Bernie Sanders has to play in order to ultimately be successful is becoming, I think in their words, increasingly complex and increasingly challenging.
I'm not sure that's true. He was way behind in the polls. That's no longer the case. In national terms, he's been doing very well. And as we all recall, pretty clearly, since we're in Wisconsin, he did extremely well in the Wisconsin primary, and won it by a noteworthy margin. It's a smaller state, but historically, it's been a more pivotal and crucial state. His appearance at Carthage College, and naturally, we're very glad that any presidential candidate comes to our campus. His appearance at Carthage College, I'd never been around him in person before. He's not my candidate, but as a practicing politician, I can see how he got elected to federal office and became a national contender, despite his views, which are much to the left of the average American. His ability to communicate an old-fashioned stem-winding orator, as I mentioned in the column, his ability to create a positive dynamic with the audience, the in-person impact, to me, was quite striking and something I hadn't really grasped or appreciated simply by watching him in the electronic media.
So you sound like you are not as... It sounds like you take very seriously the possibility that he could perhaps be successful. He could become his party's nominee.
It's a long shot, but New York doesn't wrap it up. The media emphasis this morning, since the media has no long-term memory, and it's very valuable, therefore, that we have your program and others, especially on NPR, this kind of instant analysis is overdone as usual. No, she hasn't gotten it locked up, and she's well aware of that,
right.
which is why your campaign has become so intense, and she's become so nasty very directly in talking about her opponent.
Right. Yeah, that's for sure. I don't think NPR was saying she had it wrapped up. I think they were just, and in fact, I think they showed some restraint probably compared to commercial broadcasting in just saying that
it's not an easy road.
That's
part of what I just said. That's right. Yeah, there is more depth to public broadcasting.
One of the points that was made in the Chicago Tribune article, I don't know that I'd seen this someplace else, is evidently Bernie Sanders outspent Hillary Clinton in New York, which would indicate that he cared a great deal about the New York primary and, you know, was maybe hoping to score what would have been a significant upset.
Yeah.
But I was surprised to see that, given the fact that Hillary Clinton's campaign is obviously... a very well-stocked coffers.
Right.
It surprised me that Mr. Sanders would have been able to outspend her.
He mentioned during his speech in Kenosha, and understandably he mentions this regularly, that he has gotten a very large amount of support from mostly small donations. He's gotten a tremendous income, even though he does not take money from PACs or super PACs. That's significant. It's obviously a high-stakes primary, and you're right to emphasize the fact that the campaign spent a lot, and his in particular. He's in a position to spend more, and he has to because he is behind. There are wild cards in this campaign as well. I don't believe the FBI investigation of Mrs. Clinton's famous email practices has yet wrapped up. If she is indicted, that will throw everything up in the air. It's interesting to me that Vice President Biden is still keeping his name in the news, and Mrs. Biden has been very active. I believe that he's quite ready if the Clinton campaign, for whatever reason, was upended to enter the fray. For the first time in a long time, we have possibly one and potentially two conventions where the nominee will not have been selected for sure by the time the convention meets. That hasn't happened for a half century.
Yeah, that would be really amazing.
For 6 decades, actually. The Republican convention in 1952 was the last truly contested convention, as we've discussed on your program before. In 1976, Ronald Reagan challenged a sitting president, the one elected, Gerald Ford, and it seemed like a contested convention, but Ford never lost his hold on a bare majority of delegates. Hmm. That's been a long time.
Yeah, we have a very good chance of having drama for sure at one of these conventions. And as you say, that's a very real possibility. There could be plenty of drama at both.
Yes.
Mr. Trump's victory was a resounding one on the Republican side, of course. And the news is not only of that victory, which in and of itself is probably not surprising at all, but maybe the margin of it, and the fact that Ted Cruz actually finished third, which really mm-hmm. breaks a string of strong showings which he's had in the last few primaries. Were you surprised that Mr. Cruz did as poorly as he did, and to what do you attribute that?
He has seen regional differences are still important, to put it mildly, in American politics, and he's seen very much, not just as a Texan, but as a Southerner, his attack on New York values to please the hometown crowd obviously didn't play well in New York, and it's been widely publicized, not just by the Trump campaign. I think his style is less effective before the fact as well as after the fact. I felt this. His style is less effective in more metropolitan and urban populations of the country. Kasich did quite well in New York City, especially in the parts of Manhattan that used to elect John Lindsay, a liberal Republican who later became a Democrat, to Congress. In that sense, it's not surprising. The Pennsylvania primary next week will be very important. They tend to go with more moderate Republicans historically, including Dwight Eisenhower during that epic battle 6 decades ago for the Republican nomination. They join New York and Ohio. There is an outside chance that Kasich could win Pennsylvania. Hmm. He's still in contention.
Really?
I believe, sure. If it's a brokered convention, absolutely.
Right. I suppose, yeah.
And from my biased point of view, he's the only sane voice among the surviving Republicans. I'm not exaggerating. He's the only person who's actually been a responsible executive. Trump, the businessman, is pure baloney, I assure you and your listeners. He's very much a show businessman. Kasich actually has run things fairly effectively, and he's conducted himself in a responsible manner like a mature man. He's the only one left who has.
Mm. But he's his message evidently kind of lost in the fray.
Well, he's not an exciting candidate, that's for sure, in terms of... certainly no charisma, and in terms of exciting magnetism, the kind of thing I was trying to describe regarding Senator Sanders, it's not there with him, at least not yet. Maybe he'll catch fire. Who knows?
Right. Let's circle back to the Democrats for a moment. You touched on the fact that Hillary Clinton's rhetoric has really been ratcheted up when it comes to the critical things she has to say about Mr. Sanders, and to some extent back in the other direction as well. In other words, the gloves are really off in a way that they were not towards the beginning of this race, when the two of them were really speaking to one another in fairly respectful and even affectionate terms,
right?
Especially compared to kind of the bare knuckles brawl that was going on the other side of the aisle when that field was still pretty crowded and you had people desperately trying to sort of nose their way into the spotlight. But the temperature between Clinton and Sanders seems to have changed drastically since then. Were you surprised by this? Are you surprised by this? And do you see any ultimate damage somehow that's being done?
I'm not surprised by anything this year. Well, politics is often that way, and television in ways subtle and obvious feeds the feeds that, the sense of emotional intensity, I believe. I was privileged to be with our mock trial team out of town, and thanks to Mike Fegley and Herschel Kruger and Wynn Laufenberg and the students themselves, especially our mock trial team, not only won regionals, which they've done, but went to the national competition. This is a tremendous accomplishment for any small college, including our own. Large universities and very prestigious ones dominate nationals. They went last Wednesday. I went later on, and we all came back on Monday. I watched more television than usual because we don't have competitions in the evening, and after dinner with the students and faculty, I spent more time watching TV in my hotel room and was able to see a couple reruns on the news of the exchange in the debate on Thursday between Senators Clinton and Sanders, and it really was ugly. And she in particular seemed to lose control. I was having lunch in the cafeteria with several of our colleagues, and one of our female colleagues yesterday said, well, a man can do that and a woman can't. Actually, though it's come to dominate the Republican campaign from almost the start, I don't think it helps any kind of candidate in the long run. You really should keep your dignity. It may be that traditionally we have higher expectations of women, and in many ways it's tougher for a woman to run for political office, but it doesn't help anyone when you behave that way, and she probably regrets that she lost control.
So,
In the wake of New York, she's immediately trying to not exactly make peace with Senator Sanders, but she's emphasizing party unity and the need ultimately to come together, which reflects not only that she's well-advised, but she is a very experienced politician at this point.
Right. And, of course, one has a sense of that necessity. Whoever ends up finishing ahead, they really ideally will have at least most of the backers of their primary competitor come the actual election in November. Of course, what some people are talking about
doesn't always happen.
Well, of course.
It didn't happen in 64 with Goldwater or in 72 with George McGovern, and there are other examples. It's a real test
right, of
anybody who wants to be president and should be president, whether you can reestablish a sense of total party cohesion.
Absolutely. And, of course, one possibility that is being raised is the possibility that on both sides of the aisle, there might be somebody who elects to enter the race in a third party or as an independent. One could certainly see whoever comes in second on the Republican side perhaps doing that, and perhaps on the Democratic side as well. That would also be something that we haven't seen all that often, and we haven't seen a real serious such bid in a few years. Have we seen that since Ross Perot?
Yes, we have. Pat Buchanan.
Oh, right.
In 2000, I think made a nominal difference.
Right.
Difference.
I mean, the fact that I've already forgotten it says something, although partly it says something about my forgetfulness, but...
But you're right. I believe the last major third-party contender was Ross Perot. The third-party tradition in this country, however, is very, very strong. And we've regularly seen third-party candidates who have a significant impact on the election. Perot certainly elected Bill Clinton both times in 92 and 96. You're quite right about that.
For those of you just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy, and he joins us once a month to talk about various significant issues that are before us. And, of course, we've begun our conversation, as we just really had to, with a conversation about last night's presidential primary in New York, which, of course, ended with emphatic wins by both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. By the way, you were mentioning the specific ties of Mr. Trump and Mrs. Clinton to New York. Given the fact that Bernie Sanders is, I think, originally from Brooklyn,
yeah,
I guess I would have thought that he would have performed more strongly in New York. Is there anything in particular that would have undermined what otherwise seems like you know, his roots to the area and you know, and all that makes him an effective candidate? I mean, why wasn't he more effective in this race?
Well, yes, you're quite right. A New Yorker from birth as opposed to a New Yorker from adoption.
Right.
It didn't count for much in this case. We have become more cosmopolitan in this country in the sense that your local origins used to be crucial. Dwight Eisenhower went to great lengths to conceal the fact that he was originally from Texas. When he was young, the family moved to Kansas, and from early in his career, positioning himself for high office, he reinvented himself. He did various ways throughout his very successful life and career. Ike was identified with Kansas, especially perhaps after the success of The Wizard of Oz in the 1930s, but he was a Kansan. Robert Kennedy had many burdens, personal as well as political, when he sought the New York Senate seat in 1964. But carpetbagger, you know, he's really from outside, even though he was born in New York. That was one of a number of burdens that he had to struggle against, despite his privilege and despite the natural advantages he had as a candidate. And, in fact, if Lyndon Johnson had not won New York by a gigantic margin in 64, burying Barry Goldwater, Robert Kennedy would not have been able to win, as he did fairly narrowly, against Kenneth Keating, longtime Republican, a strong critic of Bobby Kennedy's brother, who went out of his way to make life difficult for President Kennedy. So Robert Kennedy, characteristically, in particular, wanted to defeat him. But the fact that he was not seen as a New Yorker, even though he had been born there, it shows how much we've changed to me over the longer term. So the fact that he's from New York probably helped Sanders, but it shows just how strong Mrs. Clinton is in what you might call traditional Democratic strongholds.
Right, right. Well, we are going to be watching the rest of this race with tremendous interest, of course, to see where things go from here.
It's been exciting so far, that's for sure.
That's one word for it. One word for it. Among the other headlines that have dominated the news, some unhappy news from several different parts of the world, including serious earthquakes in both Japan and Ecuador. And, of course, it's always sad to see that kind of thing. And, of course, an outbreak of still more violence in Afghanistan, violence created by the Taliban. And this seems to be one of those forces of disruption that seems to recede in importance and then suddenly rears its ugly head again. I know that you see this latest terrorist incident within a wider context of what is, generally speaking, positive news out of Afghanistan.
Yeah, it's good you bring that up, not because I'm so wise or even right, but because the commercial media is not only has no long-term memory, but also, especially today, when it's so intensely competitive and more profit-driven, I believe, than has been the case with serious media in the past, everything is bad news. And there are constant reports that either explicitly or implicitly state that the U.S. and the allies in Afghanistan have failed. I don't believe that's true. Our commander on the ground, the American general, stated quite accurately this wasn't just PR to try to minimize the political and public damage. That the fact that the Taliban cannot mount a major offensive means that they resort to terrorist strikes of this kind.
Mm.
They trumpeted the fact that this is their spring offensive. In fact, this is no strategic offensive. They launched a very similar attack last September, and smaller attacks occur around the country. In 2014, Afghanistan had the first peaceful transition in power in its history, with presidential elections monitored by the UN that were basically the kind of elections that we can respect and others in functioning democracies can respect. A peaceful transition in power. The Taliban went wild in terms of violent incidents around the country. That was a nuisance. Some people were hurt, some were killed, but they could not upend the election. There was far less corruption, according to reliable UN monitors who are on the ground and are really looking at what's going on in some numbers. Compared to the 2009 elections, this was progress. Women are, as elsewhere in the world, including the good old USA, but especially in the third world, women are more and more active politically, and I've written about that because it's so important, especially in a culture which is, quite frankly, still pretty medieval. It's very important. We are sending more troops to Afghanistan. I believe that is worrisome. I think the more Americans on the ground in many ways, not just in Afghanistan, that feeds our problems. But that's a strong bias of mine, and it shows that the White House, as well as the Pentagon, believes there's still a significant military as well as political threat there. Finally, the Taliban does not control any province in Afghanistan. There's no evidence. They're very good at launching terrorist strikes against high-value targets, but there's no evidence that they control the transportation, communication, supply services. I believe very strongly, partly because of experiences in my own life, that that's the crucial ingredient when any revolutionary group has significant control of the infrastructure. You should be looking for that at all times, not just the violence, not just the more obvious indicators. But
right.
That's a real sign of whether a revolution is going to be successful or not.
And you're saying they
don't.
They do not have that kind of control.
They're not popular. They're not popular.
Right.
They're very, very brutal. But there's no sense that there's a revolutionary spirit that's gripping people beyond these hardcore killers and fanatics.
Right. So the general
populace. We can still
lose.
Yeah, right. We can still lose.
But the general populace in Afghanistan seems not to be swayed. And that's fascinating, the very first point you made, especially about how these kind of attacks are, in a sense, the best they can do.
At the moment. And, that can change, but at the moment. Excuse me.
Right. So it's important for them not to be misinterpreted as indicating, in a sense, more strength than in fact the Taliban has. I mean, obviously they're strong enough to cause some damage, and it's we should not minimize the tragedy of an incident like this, but we need to be careful not to misunderstand what it represents.
Yeah, that's right. History is important, and the larger strategic view is important. Iran has been particularly hostile to the Taliban because they're not far away. The Taliban's promotion of drug trafficking and reliance on heroin poppies, among other things, for income is particularly offensive to the fundamentalists in Iran. If this weren't an election year and things were more dispassionate in American politics, I think beyond the nuclear agreement with Iran, which I support, we've had opportunities for years to work more closely with Iran against that kind of terrorism as opposed to the terrorism that they direct against Israel. Mm-hmm. Nixon and Kissinger, a very successful foreign policy team, in my opinion, were able to get Turkey quite literally to abandon the drug trade some decades ago. It's one reason it moved to Afghanistan, by, in a very disciplined way, providing subsidies and expertise to Turkish farmers to get them to grow legal crops useful to the pharmaceutical industry, which is enormously profitable and increasingly global in gigantic terms. It solved a basic problem in Turkey. The old movie The French Connection, a very good film and a pretty accurate one many years ago. That was more or less true for a Hollywood product, and it was based on the tremendous highway from Turkey to New York to the USA, because we're the principal consumer in the world of this terrible poison. It's moved to Afghanistan, in effect. Unfortunately, neither the Bush nor the Obama administrations has been able, despite some fitful efforts, has been able to reproduce that foreign policy success of the Cold War era in Afghanistan. But there's still the opportunity. And Iran could be a partner in that, I believe. That's not an academic point.
Right. You mentioned in a recent column of the significance of the nuclear summit, which was just concluded on the 1st of April. And I think you've already mentioned in today's conversation the fact that major media tends to pay little or no attention whatsoever to these kind of meetings.
Yeah.
What is sort of the heart and soul of the significance that so much of the media misses about this kind of thing?
It involves practical cooperation among countries which are nuclear powers or could be, as North Korea especially reminds us fairly regularly. Nuclear weapons have not gone away. They have remained a threat. The Obama administration is to be commended for greatly increasing international cooperation among nations which have nuclear weapons and the long-term effort to discourage other nations from developing nuclear weapons. The president has the belief, as do others, that nuclear weapons should be abolished completely. That's politically popular. It's a good-hearted view. I don't believe that's at all practical. But I think we can all take some satisfaction that proliferation has been much more slow-moving than informed experts thought would be the case back in the 50s and 60s. For that, we can thank Dwight Eisenhower in particular for spearheading the effort to set up the International Atomic Energy Agency, and John F. Kennedy, who after the Cuban Missile Crisis, a very effective wake-up call for both President Kennedy and Soviet Premier and Chairman Khrushchev, that they worked together with on the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty in 1963, one of the significant accomplishments of the Kennedy administration and one of the first of a series of important nuclear agreements. The really important one, probably the second major one after Eisenhower got the much less publicized denuclearization of Antarctica in 1959. It's of timely importance. One of Donald Trump's ongoing principal public spokespersons is a woman named Katrina Pearson, an extreme conservative from Texas. She has said more than once in major media that we have nuclear weapons, we ought to use nuclear weapons, we ought to consider this, among others. She's also quite famous and gets even more attention by wearing a necklace made up of bullets. This tough-talking woman, misguided though she may be, does directly reflect her boss, who's expressed almost unbelievable ignorance concerning nuclear weapons issues and has talked very casually within the last few weeks about Japan and South Korea having nuclear weapons. Sure, why not? Mm. It's part of his general misguided and quite false worldview that we're somehow the victim. He's not only the complainer-in-chief, he's kind of victim-in-chief in terms of aspiring to represent the American people. Utterly misguided, utterly false, and very dangerous. Mm. The President of the United States has, in legal and technical terms at least, I'm sure someone would stop him if a President Trump tried to do so, but the President of the United States has the authority to launch nuclear weapons.
That column about the nuclear summit ended with a statement that surprised me just a little bit. You wrote that today's nuclear threats emanate more from groups than from nations represents progress.
Yes, it does.
Well, I'd really like you to explain that. I mean, I think I have a sense of why you're saying that, but I want to understand it better because on the other hand, there's something really terrifying about the possibility of a group having, you know, access to nuclear weapons, and in a sense that that feels like, in some ways, an even more dangerous and unpredictable threat than a nation with whom we might have at least sort of diplomatic exchange and so on. And a nation, in a sense, you can deal with them in a way that you don't always get to deal with a group, especially a group of madmen. So I was just interested in why you are sort of framing that final point that particular way.
Good point. Thank you very much. I hadn't thought about it that way, and I should have expressed myself more clearly. Obviously, I don't celebrate any renegade group or dangerous nation having nuclear weapons. We've been very fortunate that the nations that have developed them and deployed them have been relatively prudent and moderate, including the Soviet Union, now Russia, and China. Korea is another example. What I meant to say was that nations have basically, with the exception, the single exception I mentioned, abandoned the possibility of using nuclear weapons and the stability that we've had since 1945, when they were used by us against Japan, justifiably, I believe. The stability we've had is reassuring, and the institutions and events I mentioned, I think, are part of that long process of sanity and cooperation. As far as we know, no group, no criminal group, no extremist group outside the nation state has yet developed nuclear weapons. There's a very active effort to do so. There is a significant black market emanating especially from the former Soviet Union in nuclear material. And starting with the George H.W. Bush administration, when the Soviet Union collapsed, the U.S., especially that first President Bush, who I think was very successful in foreign policy, if not in getting a second term, we've been very sophisticated and very aggressive in trying to control proliferation of nuclear materials outside of the former Soviet Union. Colonel Gaddafi, when he was riding high and in power, had a standing offer of $1 million to any American or anyone else who could deliver a working nuclear weapon to him.
Wow.
A group of former U.S. Special Forces took him up on his offer to work for him. Absolutely despicable. They didn't have direct access to nuclear weapons, but they personified the kind of threat that he represented back then. The FBI and Interpol and, I believe, the CIA were very, very skillful in tricking the leader of this group, whose name I'm not going to mention, a former U.S. intelligence operative, and some of the men around him, to a meeting in Geneva with the promise of a tremendous amount of money, and arrested him.
Good.
Yeah, that threat faded, but it's the tip of an iceberg of activity. The U.S., from what we know, has been very, very effective at limiting this threat. Components of how to build a nuke are available on the Internet. Fortunately, and we can be very thankful, I myself, thank God for this, it's very, very difficult. Even if you know how to do it, it's very, very difficult to actually build a functioning nuclear weapon. That may change in the future, but I was trying in shorthand fashion to refer to the status quo.
Right.
And, despite all the bad news and scary news, the world is on balance safer than it was during the height of the Cold War. I have to hope that's a clear explanation.
Right. It very much is.
I gotta keep to 600 words in these op-eds or they don't get published.
Right, so. Right. No, and I think it summarizes well a point you were making through the course of the whole column.
Well, I'm sorry I wasn't more clear, and thank you for bringing it up.
You have become a great fan, in many respects, at least, of Pope Francis, and he gets mentioned a lot by you in your writing, and
he's doing a lot. He's
right,
a pretty active
he admires
guy.
A lot of what you do, and of course, very recently, he made some headlines by actually taking in some refugees or bringing refugees back with him to the Vatican, I presume. And you wrote most recently about him on several different points, but offered some interesting illumination on a Bible verse that gets tossed around quite a lot. It's maybe quoted more than any other, and presidential hopeful Donald Trump within the last week mentioned that this is his favorite verse, an eye for an eye. And in your
maybe he read my column.
So I'm right.
I don't think he reads the Bible, actually.
Right. But in the earlier your op-ed from early April, you were talking about how, as Pope Francis particularly talks about this verse and lives it out, that actually in its original form, an eye for an eye is not meant to be punitive. It existed for a very different reason.
Yeah, I only learned in fairly recent years that. Since I was a child going to Sunday school, I thought it was punitive and basically negative and threatening. But in one of the major contributions of Hebrew law was to codify and civilize warfare and codify a sense of restraint for literally the first time in human history, and the Christian religion and others, including the Jewish religion, build on that. It was actually a sense of proportionality. Ancient warfare, which has continued to pretty in fairly modern times, involved unrestrained killing and pillaging. The ancient Romans were powerful and in control for a long period of time, partly because of great political skill, but also because they would engage in unrestrained killing. Caesar would massacre literally thousands of civilians, as well as the defeating and killing the opposing army. German tribes were able to surpass even the Roman army in the brutality and skillful brutality of their methods, which is why ancient Rome never conquered the German tribes. And the German tribes were able to continue with their destructive behavior right down until 1945, if I can put it that way. The world has changed a lot, and we can thank that biblical passage long term, I think, for the fact that it started to restrain the most bestial and bloody sort of human behavior. That's all. And the Roman Catholic Church historically has played a more important role. I'm not a Catholic. The Catholic Church has played a more important role in structuring, codifying, and exercising discipline in terms of restraining killing. They have played a very important role and still do, I think, in restraining warfare. We can elaborate on that if you want, but that was my point. And at a time when the mass media focuses and should focus on the negative and dark side of the Roman Catholic Church, especially this terrible, undeniable at this point, and fairly widespread, at least in this country, sexual abuse by Catholic priests and the church's cover-up in the past. They're not doing that anymore. It's important to emphasize, as I did in this column, the positive contributions concerning war and violence, and also humanitarian relief. Most of us have full stomachs most of the time, if not all the time, and it's very important, I think, to keep the tremendous role of the Catholic Church in mind, including right down to the present day, along with the two largest religious relief organizations are the Catholics and the Lutherans.
I wanted to finish out today by asking you about an article I came across in the New York Times that really surprised me. I mean, it was not surprising that I didn't know what this article was talking about, because I'm still blissfully unaware of so much in the world, and particularly in the cyber world. I just don't understand a lot of the most significant sites and companies and so on. But something about the headline grabbed my attention, and I found myself reading about a company I'd never heard of, based in China, called Alibaba. And, I mentioned...
it's a funny name.
Yeah.
Since it's associated with thieves.
Right, right. But I mentioned it to you yesterday when I saw you, that I was curious to ask you a bit about this Alibaba, which is, for any of our listeners who maybe don't know, Alibaba is a little bit like Amazon, and according to this article in the New York Times, rivals Amazon in terms of sheer size and profitability and potential influence now and especially in the future. I mean, it sounds like they could be a truly significant player on the world stage, and maybe to some extent already are. Tell us what you know about Alibaba, and maybe against the context of of mainland China's economy right now?
I probably know less than you do, since I didn't read the New York Times article. I have heard of the company. Communications and transportation is crucial to what we refer to as globalization. And the fact that it's become so pervasive in global terms means that we really have a global marketplace. It's one reason, a big reason, we haven't had the repeat of the decade-long serious inflation of the 1970s. And it's one reason why price levels have remained long-term on a relatively low basis. For working people especially, who don't have a lot of disposable income, for working people especially, the fact that basic necessities of life, except for medical care, have stayed fairly low in cost, and other things like air travel have gone down in cost, even though the price of cars and petroleum have gone up, the impact on our standard of living is really profound. That's important to keep in mind because protectionism is growing in both parties. And the Trump campaign, which is basically media-driven, has emphasized, among other things, the fact that the world is allegedly taking advantage of us. What is really happening is we have a global integration of the world economy. China does not have the infrastructure or sophistication of the United States or Japan or European nations, but they have tremendous human capital and tremendous scale. And once the technology that drives modern telecommunications and transportation becomes integrated in China, as has been the case since Deng Xiaoping opened the economy in 1992, the potential is great. So there are all kinds of fantastic things happening in China, including the growth of this company, Alibaba, among many others. It's wild. It's crazy. Entrepreneurs tend to be wild and crazy in any country. Companies have risen and fallen very quickly in China. But this one seems to be pretty durable, as you indicate. Let me also mention the U.S. remains the largest exporter in the world by far. The Soviet Union was going to bury us. They didn't. Japan was going to bury us. They didn't. China is not going to bury us. And given the ugly and often hateful rhetoric emanating especially from the Trump campaign, it's important to keep this in mind. Figures for 2015 are in. We've exported more than in 2014 every year. We export more and more as well as importing more.
So the notion of needing to make America great again, you don't buy that.
Well, I think America is very great. Protectionism is not the answer. I mean, history is very clear on this point as well. And in fact, the average person especially, if in fact we built a wall, figuratively, we can't do it literally, but if we in fact returned to pre-war protectionism, it would be workers especially who'd be hurt. I'm not just another pompous professor on this point. It's easy to talk this way when you and I are both gainfully employed, and I know what it's like to be out of work. But you're not going to help unemployment, which is now pretty low in this country, by increasing protectionism. You're going to increase unemployment, and basic consumer goods are going to go up in price. That's undeniable. It's not a matter of jobs being removed from the U.S. and given to someone in China or Indonesia or anywhere else in the world. The modern economy is far more complicated than that. And it's good you focus on Alibaba because there's a tendency sometimes for us to think that entrepreneurship is uniquely American. That's not true. Our system facilitates it, our freedom facilitates it, but we're seeing a growth in entrepreneurship around the world.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see where all of that goes. And in the meantime, I'm so glad that you were able to join us today for yet another fascinating conversation. Dr. Art Seer-Clausen, Distinguished Professor at Carthage College, it's always great to have you here and look forward to your future conversations with us.
Well, thank you, Greg. I'm glad that you're glad, and I'm glad I can come back.
We'll look forward to seeing you in the merry month of May. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, and actually on Friday as well, you're going to be hearing my conversation, an extended interview done with author Wendy Paris, whose really intriguing book is called Splitopia. and it explores divorce and some of the ways in which divorce can perhaps be a positive and healthy step, and that it is possible to have a healthy and even happy divorce